You're listening to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Psych Talk. We talk about psychology, neuroscience, and the social sciences every week. We've had all kinds of guests so far. We've had a practicing Buddhist psychotherapist. We've had an industry leader in serious video games from IBM. We've had two addiction researchers, an experimental philosopher talking about memory and free will. And today we've got another category of guests that we're going to inaugurate. Our guest is sort of playing the role of storyteller. And he's a very smart guy, but he's got a great experience to share with us. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. Alex Lev is a student heading into his first year at Yale University. He has lived in Durham, North Carolina for most of his life. And there he attended Riverside High School as well as the North Carolina School of Science and Mathematics, or NCSSM. He's a wonderfully accomplished guy, but for this interview, we'll only emphasize that he's an avid language learner who speaks Spanish fluently, has taught beginner seminars in Mandarin, Chinese, and Hebrew, has studied some Latin, and has introduced himself to so many different languages that I think he's almost memorized the first few Rosetta Stone and Pimsleur lessons. He spent this past school year studying Mandarin Chinese in Changzhou, a relatively large city in eastern China near Shanghai and Nanjing. He joined us on Psych Talk to talk about his trip to China. And largely, we tried to record his personal encounters and adventures, but at the same time, along the way, we tried to connect his trip to broader ideas about Chinese culture. You want to say hi?
Hi. Thanks for having me, Jose.
Give us a thumbnail sketch of your trip. What program brought you to China? Why did you apply? Set us up with like the initial encounter with China.
Sure. I went to China as a participant on the National Security Language Initiative for Youth program, which was started, I think, back in 2006 during the Bush administration to give students, high school students an experience learning languages that the government considered important for national security. Hmm. Or if it wasn't important for national security, that's how they got it through Congress and got funding for it. So overall, there are eight languages, and one of those, and it's a very language-focused program. And one of the specialties of the program is that when you apply, you don't apply to go to a certain country; you apply to learn a certain language. Hmm. So if you apply to learn Arabic, for example, you don't know if you're going to Egypt or Jordan or somewhere else.
That's interesting.
And most countries, most languages, do only have one country, and with China, they only go to mainland China. I applied after having taken a couple years of classes at the School of Science and Math, and our teacher told us about the opportunity, and I thought it would be a great way to brush up on Chinese before going to college, mm-hmm. and also hopefully get an excellent experience. While we were over there, we lived with host families. So I lived with a Chinese family with a host mother, some host grandparents, and a host brother. And I attended school with my host brother at the Changzhou Senior High School of Jiangsu Province, mm-hmm. Which is the number 3 high school in the province. I think almost everything is rated in China. And this is rated by the test scores that their students receive on the college entrance exams. Wow. And so this is the number 3 school in the province and the number 1 school in the city. So they set us up at a pretty academically rigorous school. And we went, and for 3 hours a day, we had language classes. And for the rest of the school day, we would have classes with the other students in politics and math and science, and their normal music, the other subjects that they would take.
Mm-hmm.
We left school earlier than they did. A lot of Chinese kids will work until 9:30 at night at school, maybe Wow. even later before coming home. But we were sort of off of our school day by 5:15.
So was your host brother leaving as well with you early?
No, so he would come home much later. And sometimes that would be because he was doing self-study or sometimes because he was taking art classes. And we can talk about that more later. It's interesting, the different paths that they provide for you to get to college.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, but yeah, before we get too caught up in your daily life in China, tell us a bit about the other people who did NISLE. I'm assuming you met them.
Yes.
Toward the beginning, and then you didn't see them much at all, right?
Well, for most of the people, yes. But there was a group of kids in my city with me. Hmm. And so I would take language classes with them. And I actually saw a good bit of them. And then when we went on like trips as the whole program to Yunnan, I saw the whole 200 people, you know, who were in China. Not all of them were on NISLI. Some of them were on other exchange programs from other countries. We were also with a couple international students from like Italy and Thailand, but they were there. They were paying for their trip there, and they didn't have the U.S. government funding their trip.
Right, right. Very convenient to have.
Yes.
So you really had all expenses paid, or
all almost? Expenses paid. You could live there without paying any dime of your own money. I think a lot of people did end up spending some money, extra money, to sort of go on to travel places and stuff, or eat more expensive food. But for most of it, yeah, we got stipends every month, and it was a very good experience with zero cost if you want it to have zero cost.
Wow. And you probably very well deserved for, like, you probably had a big application and
it's a
very selective process.
It's not very selective yet, and so I really encourage everyone to apply while it's not well known. I think it's, especially for the year-long programs, there aren't that many high school kids who are willing to take a year out of their lives to go. I did it after finishing high school, which you're allowed to do. I think that's probably a very, very good option. Mm-hmm. But there were some kids who were doing it as a year of their high school experience, so their junior year was spent in China. But I definitely recommend applying. It's much more competitive to get into one of the summer programs, but I think it's more worth it to go for a year, and it's also easier to get in.
I'd like for you to try narrating like your first couple days in China, because those are probably a little different, being jet lagged, getting used to a lot of new things at once. So like you get off the airplane in Changzhou.
We actually went to Beijing first. Okay. We went to Beijing and we had there were 23 American kids, and we had a week of intensive language learning in Beijing. When I got off the airplane in Beijing, I think it shocked me how huge the airport was, but also how quiet it was. There were not bustles of people or anything like that, which you might think that there would be at such a big airport.
So quiet as in not that many people in there?
It was quiet, like it had this eerie sort of
like civility, or
I mean, everyone in there wasn't making that much noise. Even if there was sort of a hum of constant noise, it you felt like you could just sit down and go to sleep. Like it was very, maybe I was just extremely tired, but it was very modern looking as well. We got through the airport and the airport security and everything, and then stepped out onto the street. And a lot of people say when they take their first step into Beijing, their eyes burn or something like that, just because of the air quality. Wow. They've cleaned it up a bit since for the Olympics in 2008, so it's getting better. And I didn't have any eye burning problems, but it was definitely noticeable that everything was covered in this layer of silt or some sort of, you know, that you could feel the pollution in the air. And you could do that to some extent in Changzhou too, but not as much as in Beijing. We were met by a bunch of volunteers who were Chinese kids who had been abroad on other exchange programs before. Some of them had gone to Norway, some of them had gone to Italy, a lot of them had gone to the U.S. And they were very friendly. And then we got to our hotels and had classes and went places. We got a ton of attention as foreigners, even in Beijing, where there are lots and lots of foreigners. We'd go to public places like the Summer Palace to have classes, and people would just gather around and watch us. And we'd have kids, you know, smiling at us when we said things right, or sort of frowning at us when we messed up our pronunciation. There was one woman who went over to sort of touch the hair of this black exchange student because it seemed so foreign. And so we definitely got a lot of attention. But even more attention once we moved to the smaller city, right, in Changzhou.
Did you get it? People taking pictures of you? I've heard that's one form of attention some foreigners get.
Yeah, there were people taking pictures and people asking to take pictures. I remember I went to Shanghai with my host brother at one point to see the World Expo. And we were on the train, or on the subway. And there was this German mother with two, like, blonde, blue-eyed kids sitting across from us, and my host brother asked me to ask them if he could take a picture of them. And I was like, oh, I don't know if that's the most polite thing to do. And he said, please, they're so cute. And so I asked, and she was just happy that I was asking. She said people had been taking pictures of them without asking.
Oh, really?
All day. So yeah, and it's definitely something that happens. And I think in general, foreigners are treated very nicely and with a lot of attention in China. So there's not much respect for privacy, but on the other hand, if you do anything stupid, you're still like a sort of god-like figure. I mean, TV shows, you'll have people go on who don't speak Chinese that well, but can get by, and the whole audience will be crazy with crazy for the
So it's
foreigner.
A very positive sort of exoticism that, gets projected onto foreigners, usually.
Yeah, and I think one of the things coming back that was weird for a lot of us was not being the center of attention anymore. I feel like everyone had a little bit of an ego boost while in China, that we were special just because we lived there. And I think that hopefully in the next 10 or 20 years, that will be going away more and more as people see that Chinese is not that difficult a language, and that there are lots and lots of people who are learning it, and they're all doing it relatively successfully.
Well, that was Beijing. It was sort of dirty. You went to Changzhou. You're still sort of a celebrity as a foreigner. Tell me about moving in with your host family and some surprising encounters you had with them, maybe.
Sure. My host family was very nice, and I think that we were both very awkward at the beginning, hoping not to make any sort of wrong impression.
Right.
My host brother was very shy. Mm-hmm. And I had tried to ask him in English and in Chinese on the ride sort of back to the house questions about his life and his school and his summer. And I always was getting monosyllabic responses. And then when we got to the house, I apparently just fell asleep for 2 hours in my room. Yeah, I don't remember it that well. I was very tired, I guess, we took an overnight train to Changzhou. Hmm. And but when I woke up, my host brother asked me if I wanted to see if I liked Twilight, which was a little bit of a surprise for me.
Twilight, the movie and the book series for tweens in the U.S.
Yes.
Mostly girls.
I was asking him, and he's like, about, and he couldn't think of the word. And then he remembered vampires. I was like, oh, okay, I guess. And so we watched New Moon on his laptop.
So are you Team Jacob or Team Edward?
I was paying more attention to trying to catch on with the subtitles than paying attention to the plot. But
there's the language learner in you.
Well, and I think that that's what he was attracted to as well, the fact that it was in English. I don't think that he would have liked it as much if it were just a movie in Chinese. His name was Edward, his English name, when I moved in, which I'm pretty sure he got from Twilight.
Wow.
He changed it later on in the year to L with no period or anything. It was named after a character in Death Note, the Japanese anime series.
Just the letter L.
The letter L, which is funny. He couldn't even pronounce his own name. And it's...
How did you try to pronounce it?
Air. And the sort of L and R mix-up is actually not something that's Chinese. It's more of a Japanese problem if it's something like my name, Alex. Everyone there could say my name, Alex.
Mm-hmm.
And because they have a sound in Chinese that's L.
Right.
But at the end of a syllable, it's a very weird sound for them. So there are a lot of... they had problems with words like full and the letter L and stuff like that. That's coming at the end of a word. But yeah, no, he was just L.
You always called him by his Chinese name, I'm guessing?
Yeah, I called him by his Chinese name a lot, though he wanted me to call him by his English name. When he was named Edward, that was very easy for me. And when he was named L, I sort of had to get over this, like, calling someone by a letter of the alphabet. But, so I called him by his Chinese name. The program sort of asked us to speak in English with our host siblings and in Chinese with our host parents, so that the host parents were getting something out of the exchange, because they were all volunteer families.
Yeah. So tell us about your host parents then.
So I had a host mom. The host dad wasn't really in the picture. I later learned that they had been divorced when my host brother was 3.
Wow.
And the host dad, I would sometimes hear him mentioned. He would call my host brother on his birthday, or my host brother would come home with a new basketball, and it would be like from my host dad. not from my host dad, from his dad. I never met the dad, and I never met the grandparents on that side of the family.
Did you detect any stigma surrounding the parents being divorced? Yeah.
I think that divorce is getting more and more common in China. It's not as, I think it's still not quite as acceptable as it is in the U.S., but it's getting to the point where it's almost as common, I think.
And in the U.S., I think there's partly a religious reason that there would be any stigma, but I'm not sure that's the case in China. What do you think? Maybe more tradition?
Yeah, I think tradition, I think, to some extent, especially if it's before you have kids, filial piety. It's a big responsibility there to have kids and extend the bloodline of your, of your ancestors. And so having that as, you know, to get married in the first place, there's pressure.
That's interesting. Huh. So that's your host family.
There were host grandparents too. Mm-hmm. My, host grandmother was from the Yunnan province and she,
where's Yunnan?
Yunnan is in the southwest of China. And so she was an excellent chef, and she would come over on weekends and create and make food for me,
awesome.
Which was great. And my host grandfather was he fought in the Vietnam War on China's side, and sort of like helping out down and
helping
he was stationed,
north?
Yeah, and he had a lot of hobbies. He would collect stones of not like small stones, but really large rocks that were shaped naturally like things that you could, like a rock that just naturally happened to look like a dog or a cow or something, and he loved those. And he also played Chinese chess. He taught me some of that.
What do you mean by Chinese chess? I guess I've just never played it before.
Sure. It's a variant of chess that probably had the same roots as our international chess. Somewhere in India. And it's got several differences, but the idea is the same, that you have these pieces and you need to capture your opponent's king.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did your host grandma cook for you?
Well, she cooked a lot of Yunnan foods, which meant that it was stuff that I couldn't get at the restaurants around Changzhou. So rice noodles, mi xian, with beef in them. She made what they're called, lion heads, shizito, which are these meatball-like things. And she made some of the sort of what we would consider traditional Chinese dumplings and egg rolls and stuff like that. She made a lot of things with quail eggs for me. She made some scrambled eggs with leaves that were taken from a tree that my grandfather had grown in their house. And so a lot of really interesting foods.
Wow, sounds good. And I'm surprised about was it egg noodles you said? No, rice noodles.
Rice noodles, yeah.
Those weren't common in Changzhou?
They weren't common. I think a lot of the noodles in Changzhou were wheat-based.
Mm.
The sort of noodles made from rice was something that, especially that if you mention them in China, I think a lot of people will think of Yunnan.
I'm assuming that while in China, you consumed a lot of rice.
Like, yes.
You're basically made of rice right now.
Yes. In China, the conception of the meal is pretty different. I think in here we think of having your plate, and on your plate there are several different items of food, and then you eat them all, and that's your meal. In China, you have your bowl, which is a bowl of rice. And in the middle of the table, you have different dishes that have been created for the whole family or whole group to share. And
so far it sounds more communal.
Yeah. And then when you take food, you don't just take a bunch of food and then plop it in your bowl. You actually just take from the middle and then eat your food.
Wow.
And then you will eat your rice as you eat. And sometimes in a Chinese restaurant, they'll give you a plate, not necessarily a bowl of rice, just an empty plate.
Mm-hmm.
And so Westerners, I think, you know, generally their impression is, okay, I take food from the middle and put it on my plate, then eat it. And actually what you do is you take from the middle, you eat it, and then you put whatever's left over, bones or, you know, anything that you can't eat, skins of beans that you want to spit out, on your plate. And then eventually they'll come and take your plate away and replace it with a new clean plate.
That's fascinating. I can only imagine Chinese immigrants trying to do that in American restaurants.
Right.
Or us, you know, doing it wrong over in China. Yeah. So you didn't have any trouble with that? You were prepared for that?
I wasn't completely prepared for it, but I think I learned, and my family was a nice, were nice teachers. They just would slowly bring up stuff to me. Some of it I wish I had known earlier, like just in China, you don't put toilet paper in the toilet, you put it in the trash can because their plumbing doesn't handle the paper very well.
Right. Well, that's interesting because I think a lot of Americans would say, yeah, it's never a great idea to put it in the toilet.
In the toilet.
Bowl. Right.
Yeah.
And that sounds like it's just a constraint to the plumbing, right?
Right. Yeah, so things like that I would learn, like, 5 days later, you know. It's no problem that the toilet was clogged. Just in the future, don't put... And I was like, oh.
Right. I guess that's a little awkward, but right. They were nice.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you brought gifts for them, or maybe they had gifts for you. What was the exchange like for that?
Yeah, so in China, generally, you don't open your gifts in front of the gift giver, which meant that the gifts that I had given were just given as, like, a lump to them, and it was up to them to figure out what they were and how to use them, which ended up not going too well. The shirt that I had gotten my host brother ended up wearing, and he later told me that he didn't even like any colors other than black and white on his clothing. And the shirt that I had gotten was red. My host mother was very confused with a washcloth that I had gotten her with the map of North Carolina on it, like a sort of artsy map, and she just couldn't figure out what it was supposed to be used for. She was asking me if it was a tablecloth or something like that, and I was trying to explain it in my then very limited Chinese, and at some point she just said, okay, I'll give it to my sister. She'll find some use for it. And regifting is not a cultural faux pas in China, I guess.
That's good.
Yeah.
Less economic inefficiency. Yes. My mother would love that.
Yeah. And sometimes I'd get something that I didn't like that much from them, and they'd say, oh, it's okay. I'm sure you can give it to your grandmother or your sister or your mom or something like that. So that was all fine with them. I got some very nice gifts from them. Combs were the big thing in Changzhou.
Is it because your hair is curly?
It wasn't because my hair is curly. It was... Combs are actually the product of Changzhou. I think most cities in China have some claim to fame. Oh, we are the city of whatever. And so I guess Changzhou found out that combs were not taken yet and started making these very artsy combs.
Artsy? Explain to me. So it's not the sort of made in China combs you might
have
in the
West. No. It's their artisan products, handmade. With good types of wood and stuff like that. My host mom also worked as an accountant at this Buddhist temple, and so she would be able to bring me, you know, tokens of good luck from the temple that otherwise would have cost, $30, $40, $50.
An accountant at a Buddhist temple, you said, right?
Yes.
So was she just counting the donations?
So, yeah, it wasn't exactly donations. They had turned it into something of a tourist attraction. They had the largest pagoda in Asia. At least that's what they... The tallest pagoda in Asia.
Oh.
That's what they said. It wasn't that tall, but I guess there aren't that many Buddhist pagodas.
Or is Changzhou really high above sea level?
I don't know. It was like 13 stories or something.
Okay.
So, but they charge for admission like a good 10 US dollars, which is quite a bit. And... you go in and you can climb up to the top and look out at the city.
So it's more like being an accountant for a museum. $10 right. dollars doesn't sound that expensive, though. Tell us a little bit about your experience with money or exchange rates. And you probably had to do a lot of bargaining, right? That's probably something you look for.
Yeah, so there's definitely bargaining in China, more so in sort of open-air markets, or there are specific markets that you can go to where you can bargain, not in like a grocery store or something like that. But everything seemed so cheap that it was sometimes hard to remember to bargain. Like, it was definitely very nice. I taught English briefly in China, and I would get 100 renminbi for an hour of work, which is an excellent rate even in the U.S. That's like $15 an hour.
Nice.
But with that 100, I could eat 20 meals if I wanted to eat, you know, noodles every day. And I could eat 5 relatively good meals for an hour of work. So now the Chinese people's salaries were not so high, and I think that for a lot of them, you know, a teacher lives as well in China as a teacher lives in the U.S., in that you have, you know, their salaries are much lower than the teachers in the U.S., but the cost of living is lower. The one thing that is probably not lower in China is the housing prices. It's a little bit lower, but it's still very expensive, especially in bigger cities.
Tell us a little bit more what you know about teacher pay, because I've, in the U.S., I have very warped conversation in the news that I see about China, and one thread is that, like, Asian countries have so much more prestige and professionalism bestowed on teachers.
Yeah, and it's weird. I don't think a lot of that, and it's definitely true that, you know, if you're a teacher, that's one of the highest things that you can be in society. I don't think that that's because they're paid highly. I think that, you know, a lot of them, a lot of the teachers live in dorms at the school, four teachers to a room, which doesn't sound like, you know, living a life of wealth. You know, maybe 2,000, 3,000 a month for my Chinese teacher. And think of that, it's like, let's see, 150 per thousand, so $450 a month or something. And maybe more other teachers might get closer to 6,000, 7,000, maybe even 10,000 if they're a super respected teacher. And that was also just at my school. I don't know how that relates to the rest of China. But I did not get the feeling that teachers were the rich ones. Right. There were definitely, and there was a lot of wealth in China that I saw. A lot, like I'd say, Changzhou is considered one of their smaller cities. It's got 4.5 million people, but it's still considered one of their smaller cities. And compared to that, I'd say that there were way more extremely wealthy people than I've met in my life in the U.S. living in the Triangle. So, and I think that a lot of it is when they made the transition from a really socialist economy to a capitalist economy, these people were in the right places at the right time, and made all the money that there was to be made. And now you can't get rich like that anymore. But you had billionaires, communities of billionaires, wow, living, not necessarily billions of U.S. dollars, but millions at least.
So you had billions, or at least millionaires around, yeah, lots of wealth. Some people caught lucky breaks. On the other hand, did you see destitute people, or not really in Changzhou?
You definitely saw beggars on the streets. And if you go out into the countryside, you see a lot more sort of poor living conditions. Where I think that the rich poor divide is even bigger. Like, the rich are richer and the poor are poorer in China than in the U.S. Mm. So you know, I would say that if you look at someone at the, like, sort of 10th percentile, in, you know, 10th percentile being poor, not rich, someone in the 10th percentile in the U.S., they're still managing to, you know, bathe regularly. I don't know how accurate I am with this. I'm just sort of guessing.
That's okay. Go ahead.
And might even have, you know, a home of their own, and stuff like that. While in China, if you look at the 10th percentile, you're going to not see someone who's able to take a shower every day.
Man. Well, look, Alex, we're going to keep talking about your experience. But first, I have a little break for a weekly segment I always do called the Trivia Challenge. So I'm going to jump into that. We'll have a break.
Okay.
So today's Trivia Challenge is about sort of East-West cultural differences as found in cultural psychology. And this is a pre-recorded call with a caller. It's about 10 minutes, and this caller was very good, so expect a winner. Here we go. Thanks for coming on Psych Talk. Could I have your name?
Rachel, hey.
Well, Rachel, hey, where are you right now?
I'm in San Francisco, California.
San Francisco. What's it like over there? Is there a heat wave or something like that?
Actually, it's pretty cold here usually, but today was good.
Today was good. Just to cap off a good day, we're going to have me harassing you with some questions you don't really care about, but they are interesting to me, and well, hopefully they'll be interesting to you. Today we have 6 questions. Let's do it. If you get 4 right out of 6, then you are a winner. How's that sound?
Okay, 4 correct?
Yeah, 4 out of 6 is a winner. And if you're a winner, you get a happy sound at the end. And if you're not a winner, you don't get a happy sound. In fact, you might even get a jeering, embarrassing sound. We'll see.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah, the stakes are high, right? Well, before I jump into the questions, I'm going to play my first little test sound since this is a new feature. Tell me if you hear this. Do you hear that?
I did hear that.
Good, good. All right. Well, if you end up losing, that's the only happy tune you'll hear in the next 10 minutes. I'm sorry to report.
Okay, so I better not lose.
There you go. Let's jump into number 1. I'm going to read you a few pieces of disastrously translated English. Two of the 3 are Mandarin Chinese, and your job is to tell me which was translated from Japanese. So 2 were translated from Chinese, 1 from Japanese. Tell me which one's Japanese.
Okay.
So here are your options. A is, this is written on the bill at a restaurant. It was the phrase, please check out the cashier. Then B, this is a translation of the title of an English textbook. It says, intercourse communication. And C, this is in the Game Boy version of Tamagotchi. The quote is, laboratory, please remember to flash the toilet. So those are 3 options. They're all a little silly, and they all clearly do not directly translate the meaning of the original language. So which one do you think is from Japanese?
I think the 3rd one is from Japanese.
The 3rd one. Any reason for that hunch?
I have no idea.
Let's see if you're right. And you got it right. So, I was curious if you caught on to the Tamagotchi.
That's what it was, actually. But that sounded silly, mm-hmm. So I didn't say it. Yeah.
No, that's perfectly right. You know, anything video game related, it's safe to assume it came from Japan or Japanese. Okay, number 2. You're winning so far. Good for you. So there's a lot of cultural stigma surrounding mental illness in Asian countries. And as a result, there are a lot of psychiatric symptoms in China and Japan that get attributed to what in English is called neurasthenia. So sort of a fancy name. But remember, this is like a catch-all diagnosis. So what do you think neurasthenia roughly means when it's diagnosed in Asian countries? Is it A, weakness of the nerves, B, general confusion, or C, excess emotion?
Let me go with A, weakness of the nerves.
You're going to go with weakness of the nerves, and you're absolutely right.
All right.
Actually, a little follow-up to this is that apparently – even though mental disorders are stigmatized, anything that's related to the body or to traditional medicine, like the concept of life energy and qi, is more acceptable. So the idea that like your nervous system and the energy in your nervous system has been depleted is much more acceptable. So you are onto that one. Good job.
All right. Number 3.
Yeah. Number 3, exactly. You can count 2. Good. So one important aspect of how people look at scenes around them when you're just using their eyes is what's called context sensitivity or field dependence. That means that they're paying more attention to the background of what they're seeing relative to all the movie flashing colorful objects in the foreground. So for example, if in a picture of fish in the ocean, a more context sensitive person would look at all the rocks and the seaweed and would notice the background more. So keeping that in mind, which of these comparisons is true? Is it A, Americans and East Asians are the same context sensitive on average? Is it B, East Asians tend to be more context sensitive? Or C, Americans tend to be more context sensitive?
I would say B.
You're right. You're just on a roll.
Awesome.
You didn't even think about that one. Yeah, it's sort of interesting. So like if you ask people afterwards, like, what fish did you see? Did you see this fish? Then the Chinese person will more readily recall if they saw the fish, if they also see the same seaweed in the background. So it's like the background was part of their memory. So yeah,
okay.
You're right on to that.
That's cool.
You've already got 3 right. So
you only need 1 more, right?
Exactly. Okay. Although, okay, I guess there is 1 down here. You are going to have to answer all the questions, even if you get this next one right. Okay.
That's okay.
Okay, good. But you're almost a winner. So number 4. One interesting cross-cultural difference in thinking has to do with categories. So there are lots of experiments. One of them was done by someone named Liang Huanqiu. I didn't pronounce that correctly. Let's pretend I did. And people have been shown pictures of a chicken, a cow, and grass, for example. So we've got these 3 pictures, chicken, cow, grass. and they're asked which two images belong together, just put two together. So which group is more likely to put the chicken and the cow together? Is it Westerners or Asians? So which group's more likely to say chicken cow goes together?
Westerners.
Westerners. And you're right. Yeah, so you win. Woohoo!
Awesome.
Yeah, this one's interesting, that Asians would be more likely to say, oh, well, the cow's relationship with the other pictures is that they graze on grass, so they'd put the cow with grass. And it doesn't even have to be images. If you give people a combination of words like banana, panda, and monkey, which would you say go together from that list, banana, panda, monkey?
I don't know. I would actually say banana and monkey, which is different.
You would. Well, I have some news for you. You're secretly Chinese. But, you know, maybe I influenced you by the previous question, or actually it's a good point. It's not like all Chinese people are one way and all Americans another way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So same with words, same with images. So you're already a winner, but in the home run stretch, let's squeeze in these two last tidbits.
Okay.
Number five, there are lots of surveys that have asked people about their self-esteem and self-confidence. And there are lots of different ways to compare those surveys, but of course we're looking at East versus West. So I don't think it's too hard to guess who tends to report having higher self-esteem and fewer personal negative qualities, Westerners or Easterners.
Westerners?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, okay.
So it's actually a pretty big difference. Basically, especially in the U.S., and some studies have included lots of other Western countries. You can include Canada or some European countries like England. But in the U.S. and all these other countries, it's like Lake Wobegon. Everyone's better than average. Everyone's great. Like, people express their confidence and their abilities a lot more highly in the West. And it's usually inflated to the point that it's clearly like not in touch with reality. And then it's not the same thing if you ask Chinese people or Japanese people. It might be that they feel like they need to be polite, but no matter how anonymous you make the survey, there's always a difference. So there you go. We're full of ourselves, but not necessarily better over here on this continent.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. I'll end with another interesting difference, which is that there are some social psychologists who've looked at children and what motivates them. So these two in particular are named Sheena Iyengar and Mark Lepper. I think I actually pronounced those right just because they're not Chinese. And they asked some children aged 7 to 9 to solve anagrams. Like, if you have 5 letters, you have to rearrange them to form the word tiger, something like that. And these children were told that they had to somehow choose a category of anagrams. Like, there might be animals or school, different categories. And there were 3 different ways of choosing. There's one group that just had an independent choice. Then the second group was told that the child's mom had chosen a category for them. And the final group was just told by experimenter, I'm going to choose for you. So the different ways of getting to the category. And then the researchers looked, okay, how many anagrams did these kids solve? How long did they work on them? And in which condition do you think Asian kids did best and worked the hardest when they chose independently? Is A, B is mother's choice, or C is experimenter choice?
Mother's choice.
Right on, right on.
Yeah.
So this is a really funny one. In fact, I've heard a little bit more about this, a very representative response from one of the kids, like one of these 8-year-old girls who is an American. As soon as the experimenter said, oh, we asked your mommy which category to do, and her response was, you asked my mom? Like, completely outraged. Whereas these Asian kids were not outraged, first of all, but also worked a lot harder. The other side of this is that the Western kids, when they chose independently, did best. So just an interesting cultural difference. Even as early as 7, we've already decided whether we resent our parents or whether we have to follow their command.
That is really interesting. They were 7 years old?
Yeah. 7, 8, and 9.
That's young.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for playing. Thanks for calling all the way from California.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
We got some listener questions this week. It's a little different than usual. They called in ahead of time to a voicemail number and to make sure they hear their answers explained in full and not rushed at the end, I'm actually going to put those first for Alex. We're speaking with Alex Lev. He's a student about to head over to Yale, but he took a gap year in Changzhou, China. So he's talking about that experience. So here's a question, it's pretty self-explanatory. I'll just go ahead and play it for you. And if we can interpret it if it's a little hard to hear afterward.
Hey, this is Roman Myers with a question for Alex Liu on the Psych Talk radio show. Here's, I'm a student at UNC Chapel Hill studying computer science with a possible minor in studies of the Mideast. And historically, the West has always stuck the Mideast and the Far East in the same sort of oriental boat. And I feel it's feasible for us to forget that there are at points differences, profound ones, between those four cultures. So I'd like to dive into that difference. In your travels, did you ever encounter Chinese stereotypes, attitudes, or policies regarding the Mideast? If you could, I'd love for you to focus on the Ummah, that is to say, the Muslim world. Thanks.
So I was over in China for during a lot of the sort of turmoil that has happened recently in the Middle East. So the Arab Spring and Osama bin Laden's death, I was all there to see their reactions. First, I wanted to talk about the idea of Islam inside of China. There are several communities inside of China that are Muslim. And my host family was actually a member of one of those communities in that, you know, if you ask them, do you have a religion, they would tell you that they were Muslim. My host brother didn't actually know that. One day I mentioned it to him, and he was just surprised, and he asked his mom, wait, so I'm Muslim? And you're Muslim? And she said, yeah, so are you. Because Yunnan, where my host grandmother was from, is actually one of the sort of hotbeds of minority groups in China. So they've got lots and lots of different ethnic minorities. One thing that's interesting, though, is that while sometimes some of the customs are preserved, so, you know, some Muslim Chinese people won't eat pork, and some will go to the mosque.
Yeah.
A lot of what we think of being as the main messages or dialogues seemed to me to be missing there. One day I heard that we'd be having a more devout relative come over. And I sort of asked, you know, it won't be a problem that I'm Jewish. And they just sort of looked at me like, well, why would it be a problem? Is there any relationship between Islam and Judaism? No idea there that there would be something the same there or differences. And, you know, we'd go to these noodle shops that were run by Uyghur minorities who are Muslim. And one was asking me whether I was Muslim, and I said, no. And she asked me, and she was asking me all these questions, and something about Israel came up. Not like Israel, current events Israel, but Israel just like as a holy place of worship. And I said, oh yeah, well, Jews are, you know, Jews also in Israel. And she said, oh, you guys too. Like that was something that was
A new revelation. Maybe
for
we
her.
Need people with this mindset to go like, go for peace.
Right. So I think that a lot of, for them, it's just this tradition. So what did my ancestors did this, so on and so on. And not something that that sort of defines how they view the world through religion. Though I think that you might see more of that in terms of Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism. In terms of how they view what's actually happening in the Middle East and the Middle Eastern world, I can't get into their minds, but I can say that there definitely is not the sort of hatred or fear that you see in the U.S. Hmm. When bin Laden died, there was not a sense of rejoicing. There was a sense of, oh, look, there goes the United States interfering in other countries' businesses again. Which was a sort of narrative while I was there in the news, starting out there at the beginning of the year with, maybe you'll remember, Congress was very seriously talking about trying to get China to let its currency let its currency sort of rise. Mm-hmm. And China was looking at that as being bullied by the world superpower.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, with Libya, and with Osama bin Laden, a lot of the coverage was sort of, look, here's US, the U.S. doing something bad again.
Well, do you see China starting to view itself as the superpower? Or
you know, it's I don't think so. I think that that's a view that's much more common in the U.S. than it is in China. I think whenever I mentioned that, people were like, "Oh, you're kidding! We have years and years to go before we could ever catch up to the U.S." With the Arab Spring, a lot of the, I guess, news was very censored, because I think that the government worried that that sort of sense of democracy and uplifting spirit that we sort of got from our media would spread to China. And for a while, you couldn't search for the word jasmine on any, and you actually still can't search for the word jasmine.
Or buy jasmine, like flowers.
Like
right?
Jasmine tea, and it's all very, yeah, no, but if you try to search, Molihua, you don't get anything, or in Baidu, you'll get a little notice that says, you know, some results have been restricted.
It actually tells you.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Baidu does tell you. Google just, you get a 404. Mm. You can't even access the search results page.
Wow.
If that's for a lot of things, for the English word freedom, you know, for it's not suspicious.
They hate us for our freedom. I'm hearing George Bush say.
But it is interesting to see the differences between the coverage. So in China, you had, look at all the unrest that's happening over there. How the poor, they have this word, the Lao Bai Xing, which is sort of how they describe, it literally means the old 100 surnames, and it means the common people. And everything was framed as, oh, you know, that's great for the few people who are actually caring about this and like making all the mess in the government, but what about the common people? What about the rest of the people who, you know, this is just very bitter for them. Now, you know, they don't have a government, they don't have structure, no one's buying anything because there's looting. So it was the entirety of the coverage was focused on how bad it was for them. Yeah. And even after, and you know, I try to explain, well, who do you think is doing the protesting? It is the common people. Like that's the, but, that was, I think almost everything, even after, I think that's also a reaction that a lot of them had internalized to sort of any political turmoil, anything that happens politically that is a big change. Oh, it's bitter for the common people. You know, people playing up their petty games up in the government. And so even after Osama bin Laden died, I heard, oh, well, it's just too bad for the common people. And if you try to press into that, it would be like, well, it's some political thing that's happening. And
so anything that disrupts harmony is bad.
Right. There was also a lot of incredulity when Osama was killed. The newspaper headlines would start, you know, for the fifth time in recent years, Osama bin Laden has been announced dead. You know, like, because you had all these rumors before that.
Yeah.
But I think most people ended up accepting it.
Not so in Pakistan, I hear. But
right, not so in Pakistan. But in China, I think, for that at least, most people in the end, not everyone would say it was a good thing, but everyone would say that it happened.
Well, Alex, before came in and got on air, you were telling me about a politics textbook you had. And since we're talking about the news and politics, I'd love for you to give me a very quick summary of like what its idea of government is and of American government.
Sure. So I took politics classes with the Chinese kids. And for one of their units, they had a sort of look at foreign countries and their political systems. And their way of understanding government is definitely not Lockean or, you know, anything that we would recognize from our education, I think. They don't learn about social contracts. They learn about Marxism. And they learn it as the truth, not as one theory, one way to explain government. So for them all, or for their textbook at least, and their teacher, all governments are the result of one class, the ruling class, taking control over another subjugated class, the ruled class. And the ruling, and they sort of divide governments into four types. There's a slavist government where the slave owners rule the slaves. There's a feudal government where the landowners rule the tenants and the workers. And there's a capitalist government where the owners of the means of production rule the workers who are working under them, the laborers. And then there's the socialist government where you can't really talk about classes because there are no classes, but if you had to, it would be the people, everyone, is the ruling class, and the ruled class is enemies of the state. And when the teacher mentioned this, he sort of, and you read in your textbooks that only 0.1% of, you know, of people are enemies of the state, which means that we don't even have one in this classroom, which I thought was a really funny way to sort of convince them that they were in charge.
Right. That's fascinating.
I actually, and so their textbook has other stuff. It actually got, it's interesting to see how they portray the U.S. in particular. So the there are section on the balance of, like, you know,
different branches
of government, separation of powers, explains that the founding fathers were worried that the legislative branch, which was closest to the people, would have too much power and that they might actually be able to express the will of the people. And so they took away some of its power and gave it to the executive branch and the judicial branch. And
which is, maybe seems a little skewed, but it's not that far from the truth. Like, that's why we have the Senate, like, so that the mob rule
sure.
people.
Yep. So the Senate is a result of that worrying that, you know, something like Shay's Rebellion. And so they mentioned Shay's Rebellion, which is like this little footnote in American textbooks, and it gets a paragraph here.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it raised, you know, it talks about the Articles of Confederation and then says, you know, it used to be loose. It used to be that each state had its own rights. And then now you have Shay's Rebellion, and everyone sees that, and that sort of the capitalist rulers, the bourgeoisie, realize that there's some sort of crisis and that maybe their power could be taken away. And so then they create a stronger federal government that will better be able to control the people. And they have these sort of critical thinking questions, which, like, here's one that they give you two pieces of material sources and ask you to come to a conclusion.
Okay.
But the source one is a sort of diagram showing you how power is divided between the state and the federal government. And source two is an explanation of this case. I'm forgetting what it's called in English now. McCulloch versus Maryland?
Yeah.
Yeah. About the second federal bank. Maryland had wanted to tax it and not tax other, like, state banks. And someone from the bank had sued and the state of Maryland. And so it talks about how they won, how the bank won Maryland won the statewide court. And then when it went to the federal government, suddenly the federal government won and sort of says, and then, so the question that it asks you, based on the materials above, based on the two sources above, do you think that this U.S. Supreme Court acts to protect states' rights or the executive branch's rights? It's just like, yes, based on the extensive amount of material that you've given above, one right. Supreme Court case to judge from. And it's like, how can you possibly think of another answer to that question?
Right.
How is it in your opinion? Right?
That's some critical thinking. Right.
There. But there's,
that's great.
Yeah, so things like that. They have little sections on how America is supposedly the land of the free, but they imprison more people than any other nation, or more of a percentage of their population than any other nation. And 70% of those people are racial minorities.
Yeah.
So I think that it brings up some good points. I don't think that all of it is false, but it's definitely
just
one-sided.
Different focus. Like,
right.
That is a huge problem in the U.S., but
right.
That's not, like, the one way to understand our political freedom, right?
And they also have things like it's very heavy-handed in telling you, you know, like, and this is why the capitalist system will never be able to reflect the will of the people. Or, and this is why China's system, the socialist system, is going to, you know, show its full splendor in the near future.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Let's jump to another question we had. I'm going to play it for you.
Hi, this is Shalini Chudasma, and I'm calling regarding Alex Love's interview. My question for Alex is, how do you, if at all, plan on incorporating Chinese into your future career plans? Thank you. Bye.
And actually, I'm going to add that we had one more call from China, from a good friend of mine who's studying in China, and it was so garbled that I can't play it. It sounded like some kind of electronic chipmunk. However, and her voice is beautiful. I'm not saying anything about her, but so... She was also asking about what you're going to do in the future with Chinese as you've been studying, and specifically whether you'd consider studying abroad in a program like Princeton, Beijing, or if that would not seem interesting to you having done this year. So.
Sure. I can imagine going – first I'll answer that one. That seems more quick an answer. I can imagine going to China again for a summer. I don't think I'd go again for a year because I want to have the college experience in America. As far as what I want to do with Chinese in my life, I'm really not sure yet. I definitely want to keep learning it. I don't think I want to be a diplomat type of person. And also, people tell you that, you know, Chinese is a great way, like, doorway. You'll get so many jobs if you can speak Chinese. But the truth is there are very few jobs that only need you to speak Chinese and have no other marketable skills. You know, if you have an MBA, sure, knowing Chinese is going to help with that. But if you haven't gone into business, you know, all those jobs that are for business people learning Chinese, I think, are not going to be open to you.
You haven't even gone to college yet, so what could you do wrong? Like, is there some major you could get that would, like, invalidate the usefulness of your Chinese?
Or... Yeah, I mean, I think most majors don't really have that many opportunities to use Chinese as a major marketable career skill. I think that there are very few things. One of them is business, where you're communicating with Chinese people. One of them is government, where you're translating or doing diplomatic work. But I don't think, like, you know, and, you know, there are things that you could do if you're a computer science major. You can, you know, go and work for some Chinese internet startup or something like that.
Yeah.
Or do localization or do Chinese, you know, a lot of the sort of technologies that have existed for a long time in English that have allowed us to have Google and stuff like that. There are some linguistic technologies that haven't been ported to Chinese yet that there's some work there to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking right now that I definitely want to keep learning Chinese and studying Chinese more in depth.
Mm-hmm.
And that I don't know how it's going to influence my life. I'd like to do some sort of literary translation that's like on the side at some point in the future.
Nice.
I think most literary translators don't do full time, but there's such a huge untapped wealth of Chinese literature that no one reads over here in English. We have like the classics, but no one reads anything modern in China, and really the book market is incredibly huge over there. You see kids reading novels, adults reading novels.
That sounds really important. I'd love to read those novels once they're in English, I guess. Yeah.
And even nonfiction work that, you know, would show an interesting point of view from Chinese scholars and Chinese people, and almost none of that gets translated. So,
well, Alex, I'd love to keep asking you questions all day, but we do have to stop at 3. So it's been wonderful having you here. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to Psych Talk.